Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name is James Pearson. I'm a trustee of the Manhattan Institute. And on behalf of the Manhattan Institute, welcome to this luncheon today to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the Weekly Standard and the publication of the Weekly Standard Reader. It's my pleasure to introduce my old friend, Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, and a friend of more than 25 years. Bill, I first met as a young professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and over all these years as a writer, editor, speaker, commentator, Bill has led a secret life as a scholar. Bill, as you know, is editor of the Weekly Standard and chairman and co-founder of the Project for the New American Century. Before starting the Standard in 1995, it is hard to believe it's been 10 years. Mr. Kristol led the project for the Republican Future, where he helped shape the strategy that produced the 1994 Republican congressional victory. Before that, he served as chief of staff to Vice President Dan Quayle during the Bush administration. From 1985 to 88, he served as chief of staff and counselor to Bill Bennett as Secretary of Education. Before coming to Washington, Bill served on the faculty of Harvard University's Kennedy School and the Department of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Bill has published, written articles, essays, really too numerous to count, including, of course, being the editor of the Weekly Standard Reader. He is co-author with Lawrence Kaplan of the best-selling book, The War Over Iraq, widely recognized as one of the nation's leading political analysts and commentators. Bill regularly appears on Fox News. He serves on the boards of the Manhattan Institute, the John M. Ashbrook Center for Public Affairs in Ohio, and the Shalom Foundation in Israel. He received a bachelor's and PhD degrees from Harvard University in government, and Bill is married, his wife Susan, and three children, and they live in McLean, Virginia. I believe when the Weekly Standard began 10 years ago in 1995, right after the Gingrich victory, it was said that the purpose of the magazine was to guide conservatism from a doctrine of opposition to one of governance. It's been a rocky 10 years. I commend everyone to read, take a look at the 10th anniversary issue, which is on your tables, has a great deal of good material, including Bill's own reflections on 10 years as editor of the Weekly Standard. As you know, it's been a rocky road. My favorite comment in here is one that he reports conversation with Fred Barnes at an early editorial board meeting. Bill was a little skeptical about one of the articles that they were publishing. He said it lacked some important qualities, and Fred Barnes pointed out that it had one important quality, which was the quality of doneness. And that reminds us that editing a weekly magazine is inherently a conservative activity because one can never be a perfectionist and a utopian while editing about producing a magazine every week. My pleasure to introduce to you Bill Kristol.
I think we can do this sitting down. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for that nice introduction. I want to thank certainly the Manhattan Institute for sponsoring this panel on the occasion of the 10th birthday of the Weekly Standard. Someone from The Economist called me. I think they're doing a little piece on the book and the deep meaning of the Weekly Standard after 10 years, called me this week and said that from a British point of view, 10 years was nothing, and how could you celebrate such a birthday? especially if you're a conservative, you know. And I pointed out that we were an American conservative magazine, and for us, 10 years is a long time. You know, we actually originally, John remembers this well, planned to call the magazine because we were concerned with sort of a distinctively American conservatism, articulating that and debating that. We originally planned to call the magazine The American Standard, but then one of us went into a men's room in a hotel one day, and I assume it's the same in the ladies' rooms, I don't know, and just thought maybe that wasn't the best name, so we switched. I think we were going to use The Standard by itself, and that's someone had a copyright on that, or some newsletter or something, so we ended up with a weekly standard. I'm just here to moderate and briefly introduce Fred, Jody, and John, none of whom needs any introduction. And I will, Jim mentioned the book, which I, is available outside, the 10th anniversary edition. It's not, I resisted calling it the best of the Weekly Standard because, though I think everything in it is among the best things that have appeared in the Weekly Standard, there's an awful lot of very good things that didn't make it into the book. But it is, I think, a good collection. It's diverse. It's I was looking at it again last night. I was always reminded of something else I liked or had forgotten in the book, but it's divided into five sections. The first, somewhat perversely, but maybe this is appropriate for a conservative magazine, consists of obituaries. We're a very forward-looking, cheerful group, you know. I think we call it appreciations to take the edge off the fact that all these people are dead. And these are sort of, Fred's actually a lovely piece about his father is the first one, and includes Jody on Pope John Paul II, and many, I wrote something on Pat Moynihan, a terrific piece by Larry Miller, actually, on Johnny Carson. So an interesting first section, I think, then a group of essays on politics and society, peace and war, books and arts, is the biggest section, actually, and then some of the miniatures, which are the casual, if you know the magazine, some of those at the end. So it was nice putting together the book. It's somewhat reassuring to find out that at least some of what you published seems to stand up okay after 10 years, and then we do have this 10th anniversary issue with a pretty interesting symposium in it. You know, symposia, generally we have shied away. I remember John, Fred and I discussing this right at the beginning from symposia because they usually sound like better ideas than they actually work out to be for the readers. You know, let's get 20 really smart people to write on one topic. And it's, as I say, it sounds like a good idea. When you're actually wading through the 13th contribution, it can be a little tedious. But this one, we, I think, hit upon a pretty good question, which was what have you changed your mind about, if anything, over the last 10 years? And we got some interesting oddball answers from our interesting oddball regular contributors. So I recommend actually several of those contributions. Let me I won't really do a proper introduction of my colleagues, but simply say that Fred has been the executive editor, of course, of the Standard from the beginning, one of the co-founders, John, Fred, and I guess were the core group, but along with many others, David Brooks, Andy Ferguson, Chris Caldwell, Richard Starr, Claudia Winkler, now Claudia Anderson, and almost all of them really have, almost all of us have stayed together. John couldn't resist coming back here to New York and obviously writes an indispensable column for the New York Post. Jody joined us after a couple of years, stayed for 7 years, and has now come back to edit First Things. I guess David Brooks deserted us to go over to the dark side on the New York Times. He had prepared for that by doing the News Hour for a couple of years, so he was used to that culture. And but I think actually almost the rest, and David and John and Jody, are all still contributing editors and closely associated with the magazine. And I think actually almost the rest of the core group has stayed together, which as a personal matter and a sort of human matter is very nice and makes it's a very nice group of people, actually. So Fred, of course, was a journalist for years before that. That's how he got to know so much about the quality of Dundas and the New Republic for about a decade before the Standard. Jody came to us from First Things and went back to edit First Things, which he is now editor of, and had a terrific piece. And was that the first issue that you were fully responsible for, I think, the last issue, a terrific piece on the death penalty. So, but he's certainly staying in close touch, had an excellent long piece in the back of the book, even longer before Phil Terzian edited it. But as Jody, having edited people's pieces for 7 years and cut them ruthlessly in half, had to have a slight bit of his own medicine on that piece. But it was almost as good in the cut version as in the full version, but a wonderful piece on American memoirs, and that's in that issue. He's in the book with an appreciation of Pope John Paul II and a terrific essay on Robert Lowell, and also a reminiscence of Christmases as a child in Pierre, South Dakota. Very similar to my youth, really. And, and then into John's, too. And John obviously came also from New York to start the magazine with Fred and me. I think it was probably more John's inspiration or insistence that this was the right time to start a magazine at the end of 94, beginning of 95, that probably more than anyone else, caused us to do the magazine. John's well represented in the book with an essay on Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani, an essay on Stephen Sondheim. He has diverse interests, and also a good contribution to the symposium, remembering how thrilled we were by Newt Gingrich's taking on Bill Clinton and shutting down the government. That was some of the really fine, perceptive political analysis we offer. We offered our readers back then and still try to do it today. Anyway, so I think each of them will speak for just a few minutes, and then we'll talk for a bit, ask them a question or two, and then we'll throw it open for questions. Fred?
Thanks, Bill. I thought I'd talk for a couple of minutes about how we happened to start the magazine, and I give Bill and John more credit than myself. But, since we started it, the question I am asked most about the Weekly Standard, and I'm not making this up, and that question is, how often does the magazine come out? You'd be surprised how often that gets asked. I spent 10 years at the New Republic magazine at a time when it was not quite as liberal as it is now. Of course, in an earlier era, it had been pro-Stalin, but I wasn't there then either. Charles Krauthammer was there when I was there, and there were several others. But I was struck that the New Republic, a weekly Washington-based magazine on policy and politics, was eagerly sought every Thursday morning when it came back from the publisher by the Reagan White House, the most conservative presidency of the 20th century. And it struck me sometime in my tenure at the New Republic, I was there from 1985 to 95, that if the Reagan White House wants the New Republic so much, and it did have a White House Watch column that I wrote, a column that goes back that was, I think, originated by John Osborne back in during the Nixon presidency, perhaps earlier. Shouldn't there be a weekly Washington-based magazine on politics and policy that is conservative? Now, I didn't think of that as a magazine that would compete with National Review, which is a great magazine and obviously has played a great role in the rise of conservatism in America, but it comes out every other week, and it's from New York. I always thought of the New Republic as more of a rival, though ideologically they're quite different. So when a meeting was set up, I guess I'd expressed my interest in this to Bill at some point along the line, and I'd met Bill in Washington when he came in, 85, or was it 86? 85, when he came to the Education Department, and then he took my advice and became Chief of Staff to Dan Quayle. Never pass up a White House job if it's offered to you. You can have considerable influence there. And we had a meeting at the Jefferson Hotel in Washington in January of 1995, and we agreed it was probably a good idea, and Bill, through Erwin Stelzer, had met one of the greatest Americans of all, Rupert Murdoch, and I say that with total sincerity. Bill met with him. He liked the idea of a conservative weekly magazine from Washington. We then went to California to his house and met with him in March. And by May, John was on board working in Washington, and so was Bill. I came in June, and others did as well. And the first magazine came out the Monday after Labor Day in 1995. Some of you all may remember the cover. It had Newt Gingrich on it, all armed to the teeth, and the headline was Permanent Offense. Newt was saying Republicans, after the election of 1994, would be on permanent offense. And of course, within a matter of days, they were on what seemed for a while like permanent defense. Just one of our many prescient covers that we've had. I would like to knock down one myth about the magazine, and that is that we are a knee-jerk pro-Republican magazine. Obviously, we're a conservative magazine. I know this is true because I know so many people who complain about what Bill has said and written, mainly, including Donald Rumsfeld and President Bush and so on. But we've actually changed our mind on a number of Republicans. Newt Gingrich, he was the man providing permanent offense for Republicans. Early on, we had an article in our magazine that said, Newt Gingrich must run for president. And you know who it was written by? It was written by that great conservative, Arianna Huffington. to this day, I blame Bill for, maybe it was you, John, for, it was John. I don't know, maybe you can come up with a better one, but in 10 years, I regard that as the worst single article ever to appear in the in the Weekly Standard. But we changed our mind on Newt Gingrich, and myself and others were writing critical of him actually within a few months. Trent Lott. I once, after something Bill wrote, remember what you wrote about Trent Lott? Got a 20-minute lecture from Trent Lott when I was down at Fox News one day about how bad the New Republic was and how it was not contributing to the success of the Republican Party. I tried to briefly explain what the mission of the magazine really was. Yeah, the Weekly Standard. What the magazine, its real purpose was, but he was not interested. One of the cleverest pieces we had was about John Kasich when he was the House Budget Chairman. It's a piece written by Andy Ferguson. It was so clever that the piece was actually something of a hit job, but John Kasich thought it was favorable. That is very deft writing, and Andy was good at that. If you remember also back to our first issue, somebody wrote a piece urging Colin Powell to run for president. I don't remember who wrote that, but it was in the magazine, and certainly a few years later when General Powell was Secretary of State, we took a completely different approach toward him. One other thing, one of the missions of the magazine, I think, and why I'm sorry that David Brooks is not still writing for the Weekly Standard, but is writing for the New York Times, I think one of our missions is to create journalists, young or old, that the mainstream media can't help but hire. And David Brooks became such a star at the Weekly Standard, I think it was logical and obvious that when there was an opening for a conservative columnist at the New York Times, would have to hire him, and of course they did. And now, one of our young reporters, Catherine Mangu Ward, was hired recently to be the researcher and assistant to John Tierney at the New York Times, also a columnist there. She doubled her salary, so I did not discourage her from going. The one other thing I would mention is, when we began the magazine, we sort of divided up different people. I was interested in hiring some people, and John was interested in hiring some, and Bill had his favorites, and so on, and you'd probably find it hard to guess who, you'd probably find it easy to guess who recommended whom. Probably the most inspired one was John's recommendation of Matt Labash, who has become a writer with a huge following around the country. Probably more than anybody else at the magazine, he has a non-conservative following. I'd never heard of the guy. I don't know, John, John, you must have run into him someplace, but I'd never heard of the guy, but what a great find. The two I had urged very strongly are both gone from the magazine. Practically nobody's gone except the people I recommended. One is Tucker Carlson, who's gone on to be, was a great writer for us. He shouldn't have given up writing, but he's gone on to be a television star on MSNBC. Nothing wrong with that. And the other was Matt Reese, a young man who'd been an intern for me at the New Republic. He happened to be at the Brussels edition of the Wall Street Journal. I called him, and he came back immediately to join the Weekly Standard. Now he went on to be a speechwriter for Condoleezza Rice and so on, and it doesn't look like he's coming back. 10 years does seem like a short time, but we really have, I think, achieved remarkable things. Not only do we have a huge conservative base of readers, but we've done something that I always thought was important that the New Republic did, or used to do, and that is penetrate the political community, the journalistic community, and the academic community. We do a great job in the political community, particularly in Washington. The journalistic community really has to read the Weekly Standard the way 10 or 15 years ago they had to read the New Republic. The academic community, Jim, we're working on that. Thanks.
Seems obligatory to mention how quickly 10 years has gone by. Actually, as I was walking up here, I abandoned my cab somewhere on First Avenue because of the UN situation and walked the rest of the way. And as I was walking up here, I was remembering a line of the great writer of American epigrams, J.V. Cunningham, who had a little epigram that went, of 30 years I gave 10 years to rhyme, that thus time should not pass, thus passes time. And it's 10 years seems to have just disappeared. Those 10 years that the Weekly Standard has been in existence are exactly the 10 years in which I've been in the conservative world. I was a professor of medieval philosophy and unhappy, and Midge Dector and Richard John Newhouse found me and started publishing me, gave me a job, and then the Weekly Standard, John Podhoretz asked me for a piece on Thomas Mann, of all unlikely things, and like within 3 months, I was a contributing editor, and a few months after that, John and Bill and Fred invited me down to lunch at the in Washington and offered me the back of the book, which I then edited for 7 years, and it was and I've only come up to New York this summer again. It was an extraordinary time to be there, and a lot of fun. You know, one runs into people who have theories of magazines, and they're usually the magazine's best readers, but they believe all kinds of things are planned, when actually mostly what you're trying to do is just get the thing out the door. So you run into people who say, isn't it significant that that review appeared as the number 3 review? You say, no, that's because that's where the ads fit. You know, it is the case, as Fred said, and as Jim Pearson recollected, that things had to have the quality of doneness, and that it's a conservative impulse to recognize that you will never reach perfection and you ought not to have utopian dreams. Nonetheless, as I said in apology once to a typo that had appeared in a piece by Joseph Epstein, it must needs be that typos come, but woe to him by whom they come. And it's there's some deep planning, nonetheless, that does actually happen. Some of it is incidental. Most of those obituaries that start the book at the 10-year reader actually appeared in the back of the book. It reached a point where Fred Barnes began referring to the back of the book while I was there as the books and obituaries section rather than the books and arts. But there's some kind of guiding ideas that happen and begin to influence things. One, for instance, is this. I remember taking Bill out to lunch one day and saying, unless he was going to fire me, I was never going to run another Culture Wars piece, that the Culture Wars were over, and that I never again would run or read a piece on how bad the women's studies department was at Smith College, that it was over, that we had done that work, there was nothing new to say, they were all the same piece, and could we just leave it? The job had come to the point where our task now was to do the good rather than complain about the bad. Didn't work out, but still, that's a deep idea that eventually begins to influence one, and we began running series of pieces on old movies as a result of this, a series of pieces designed, hung on the hooks of new biographies of old writers that really aimed merely at teaching people once again how Robert Lowell, for all of his faults, is unavoidable as a poet, how mystery writer, the horror writer H.P. Lovecraft is a forgotten American original, and pieces like this. And I think it's one of the most useful things that a conservative magazine can do. Now, we get things wrong. I got things wrong in the back of the book so often. I never figured out how to do movie reviews in a timely way. My belief that the single worst cover we ever ran while I was there was the one that had Charles Krauthammer on the cover saying, "Be very afraid, Deep Blue has just beaten the world chess champion." And up in the corner slash was a little tag that said, "No need to be afraid of cloning," at James Q. Wilson. And really, my phone feeling is that it ought to have gone the other way on those two pieces. Still, there's something that happened at the Weekly Standard, some way that brought together a variety of conservatives and let them inform each other. And something deep happened. When John brought me down and I had lunch with Fred and Bill at that first meeting, and we talked about it and it all looked good and they were offering me the job, and I don't know, some imp of perversity struck me and I said, well, there's one thing I have to say. I come out of a very Catholic world. I'm a social conservative with literary and philosophical interests, but still a real social conservative, and I said, I know it's not going to happen, but per impossibile, if the day ever comes when the Weekly Standard runs an editorial signed David Tell for the editors that says we conservatives should all embrace Roe v. Wade, I can't be one of the editors for whom that speaks. And Bill Kristol sort of looks down like, oh, great, my literary editor is dictating to me now. And he sort of looks down, and he picks up his fork and starts drawing lines in the pressed, you know, that starchy fabric of the tablecloth there at the Mayflower. He's drawing lines with his fork, and he says, I don't think you have to worry. We are square on abortion and getting squarer. It strikes me that on a lot of conservative issues, people who came to the Weekly Standard from different camps got squarer with one another. And that's one of the deep contributions that the magazine has made over the last 10 years.
Well, I'm in an odd position on this panel because my connection to the Standard, which is very deep, nonetheless, in terms of managerial role, ended just about 8 years ago. And so I come to the Standard largely in the 10 years as a reader and as a writer for the magazine. What I think is striking about the Standard, despite the presumption that it's that among its authors, among its editors and its leaders, that a lot of things were square and getting square, was an atmosphere of intellectual heterodoxy that I think continues to this day, that was present in that eccentric first issue, as first issues always will be, because we were not yet certain of the format, we were not yet certain of how lengthy our articles were going to be, how we were going to lay them out. We had various notions about it, but there was a piece by Bill on Colin Powell possibly running for president, which was not necessarily a work of advocacy, but a work of political explanation about why this might be a clever and salient move on Powell's behalf. That was a very heterodox thing to publish in September of 1995, when there was an orthodoxy in Republican and conservative circles, where Republicans and conservatives had essentially reached a kind of, they had twisted around each other like strands of DNA, and something that was to end pretty sharply over the next 3 or 4 years, as half of the Republican agenda that animated the 1994 enormous midterm election that really gave birth to the Standard, that half of that agenda was essentially tossed by the wayside, the half of the agenda that was dedicated to the idea that government needed to be limited. But in September of 1995, it was in fact presumed that Newt Gingrich was not only in some senses the political leader of the right, but that he was the intellectual leader of the right, even though you could have questions about how serious an intellectual he might or might not be. And that to say, hey, you know, here's an interesting scenario, you know, maybe a moderate black general running against Bill Clinton in 1996 might actually win the election. And that remains an interesting and open question, it seems to me, given the results in 1996, that the ability to pose provocative questions, to say here is something to look at and think about, made the Standard somewhat different from magazines on the right that had preceded it. That it was interested in questions both of governance and of how politics worked, how politics worked, which, strangely enough, though everybody now loves to talk about, you know, a lot of political journalism now is about markups and which bill, how they're going to reconcile this bill and that bill. When I became a journalist in Washington in the 1980s, unless you were a congressional correspondent or an academic, unless you were a political scientist with a specific concentration on the workings of Congress or the workings of the executive branch. These were things that were invisible to most people, completely invisible. They played no role in how intellectuals thought about how politics worked. And the ability, which I think I ascribe really both to Bill and to Fred in the sense of wanting to have a strong repertorial cast to the magazine's journalism, and Bill in the sense of refusing to, anytime an idea became a conservative shibboleth or a conservative, you know, like an absolute marker, you'd start going, oh, wait a minute, you know, this is, there's something sentiment, that's, maybe that's going a little too far. Maybe people are getting a little hysterical about this. So that, and through the course of the magazine, the publication of heterodox pieces on these subjects was something that went and continues to this day. Erwin Stelzer writing a piece opposing the elimination or even the substantial reduction in the estate tax on the grounds that this was actually bad for society. An extraordinarily heterodox opinion in conservative Washington circles. Our insistence in 1997 that the foreign policy of the United States should be turned and directed toward the threat from China, something that there were maybe two politicians on Capitol Hill, Chris Cox, who is now, what is he, trade rep? SEC. Anyway, one or two politicians on Capitol Hill took the Chinese threat seriously, and this was not something that was very much thought of. The Republican Party was very happily taking a lot of money from corporate donors who like to work with China. And that openness to the notion that the way politics was being done was problematic, or the willingness to open one's eyes toward things that very rapidly became things one was not supposed to question. These were new contributions in Washington political circles on the right. It was the great weakness on the right in the 1980s and the 1990s that people sought lockstep. It's a presumption that because the conservative movement was an alliance of disparate groups, that some were passionate about gun ownership over here, some were passionate about abortion over here, everyone could see everybody else's point, that you did not offend Group A lest Group A become upset and start turning against the interests of Group B. And that, I think, is the signal contribution that the Standard made and in some sense continues to make, that even in matters, you know, and in many cases there are things that I disagree with, that I published that I disagreed with, and that I disagree with today, but that represent a brand of intellectual honesty that in all candor was not necessarily going to be present on the right if you look back without the Standard's presence, because the pressure was so omnipresent that to say critical words of determined conservative policies, either about their implementation or about the way they might be done or about the way they might be construed, was to be considered a traitor in some senses. And I feel like the Standard gave space to people who wanted to think deeply about whether or not any individual given issue was an issue on which you needed to go to the mattresses, to take it all the way, to commit all of your heart and blood and treasure. And of course, after September 11th, which I think I'm maybe the first person to mention September 11th, when in fact we faced the first mortal threat that had arisen, new mortal threat that had arisen in the course of the magazine's existence and since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, that at that point one understood why it was so necessary to have that kind of intellectual honesty, because it meant that if you stood up and said, you know, this is a fight that must be made not only because we've been attacked, but because of a series of ideas that had been expressed, say, in the magazine over the course of years before, about how American power needed to be extended, about what the purposes of American power were, and about why American power needed to be expressed not only in pursuit of a narrow national interest, but in pursuit of ideas about how the world should function in an atmosphere conducive to democratic change, as opposed to an atmosphere conducive to stable and orderly continuance of present circumstances. That the magazine, therefore, had a unique cachet after September 11th, and really represented a mode of thinking that was consistent, that became the underpinning, controversial though it may be now, of the Bush doctrine, leading to the incredibly and remarkably ironic fact that this famous neoconservative conspiracy, two-thirds of the editors having grown up 24 blocks from each other on the Upper West Side, with parents who were routinely mistaken for one another, that the neoconservative conspiracy became essentially the source from which an administration made up of a born-again Episcopalian Methodist, Connecticut Texan, a Wyoming wastrel turned White House chief of staff, a pianist provost from Stanford, all of these non-Jewish, non-Upper West Side, non-neo anything people should essentially have found their inspiration source in a magazine, and again, strikingly and most strikingly, as is always true of intellectual magazines, a magazine that whose readership is small, whose following is, you know, in historic American terms, is tiny, but whose voice at a critical moment in American history was a clarion call to American purpose. And if there was, if anything suggested that the Standard had needed its creation, it was not the coming of the Gingrich Revolution in 94, which is what we thought when we had our first meeting at the oddly named Utopia Coffee Shop on Amsterdam between 72nd and 73rd. It was that there was a body of thought that had been developed to strengthen and give weight and purpose to, you know, what came to be the Bush Doctrine 6 years later in an attack that we could not even have imagined the day that first day 6 years earlier when we finally sent the first magazine off to the printer. Thanks.
Let me, while some people who have to leave go, I just add 3 footnotes, and if I could, and throw it open. First, I could see Leslie Cohen of HarperCollins. She's in charge of marketing the book and doing an excellent job, and she's telling everyone that the book's full of really, the Weekly Standard is really an excellent magazine, And I can see her turning a little white as one panelist after another explained how wrong we got everything. Picked his own candidate for worst article ever.
It's not in the book.
Well, no. And then, of course, stressed to a group of Manhattan Institute friends and trustees here in the Princeton Club in New York that one of the articles that is in the book, in fact, is a defense of the estate tax. So that was good. That was intelligent of us. But anyway, we have thought privately in the office. We will at some point do a privately published Worst of the Weekly Standard, but we won't ask HarperCollins to market that, I don't think. But it would be shorter than the Best of the Weekly Standard, I hope and think. Yeah, well, thank you. Right, that's true. Marketed on left-wing websites. You know, I mean, unfortunately, they already have the Worst of the Weekly Standard. That's all preserved on the Internet. Secondly, Fred made just a comment in passing about Rupert Murdoch, and I do want to say a word about that. Partly because this is going to be preserved, I guess, on the Manhattan Institute's website. And Rupert, of course, likes to go to the Manhattan Institute website late at night and watch the streaming video of panels like this. And I certainly don't want to be in the position where Fred praised him effusively and I was entirely quiet. So let me say for the record that I agree with Fred. No, but Rupert, when we started the magazine, we actually, the only sort of contractual issue, I mean, it wasn't an issue, but the only really thing that's in the contract that's of any interest is that we would have editorial independence, and we have had for 10 years, and it's been utterly, Rupert has been utterly scrupulous about that, and there's never been a hint of anything on China where we really did differ. I mean, I argued with him about it, but he let us be pretty, issue many warnings about China at a time when he had a really different view of the development of China. I think the jury's actually out on which of us was right on that, and we've probably both modified our views somewhat over the last 6-7 years, but so he really has, apart from all the other accomplishments that for which he deserves praise, just as the News Corp, as our corporate owner, and Rupert as chairman of News Corp, have been really terrific. We have had editorial independence to make our own mistakes, or not mistakes, as the case may be. And third, just a word on this issue of neoconservatism, which, since it's so often now called a neoconservative magazine, this would require much more time than anyone wants to give it, but it wasn't started to be a neoconservative magazine. I think Norman Bernhardt had given a talk, and which was published, I think it was that year actually, wasn't it, 95, saying neoconservatism made a great contribution to America, but now is basically merged into conservatism, and it doesn't seem to be a distinctive movement or even persuasion anymore. My father had published that same year his book of sort of a collection of essays going way back to the late 40s, Neoconservatism, Autobiography of an Idea, which I think implied at least that it was sort of the end, that this was these were the years of neoconservatism and it was now time for something new. We didn't intend to have a neoconservative magazine. I wouldn't say most people at the Weekly Standard came to conservatism through neoconservatism. I wouldn't say most of them would even today necessarily call themselves neoconservatives on the religious issue, not that we ask anyone there his or her religion, of course. But the great irony has always been the Jewish conspiracy argument, since once John and David Brooks deserted me, I was alone, I believe, as the only Jew actually at the Weekly Standard. Finally, we hired a young kid out of Princeton last year, his 22-year-old, to keep me company. You know, but it is actually predominantly, it actually looks like America, as they say, the Weekly Standard. You know, it's full of Protestants and Catholics. It's quite shocking, of course. But secular people, religious people. But I do think it's fair to say, just whatever, you know, well, we call ourselves, I mean, there has emerged in the history of the Standard, especially since September 11th, sort of some somewhat distinctive form of conservatism that people call neoconservatism, and that's fine with me. And it has a relationship with the original neoconservatism. And I do think it emerged pretty quickly, if unanticipatedly. I mean, I would say markers for me were our support of Clinton's intervention in Bosnia, which we regarded as belated, whereas most Republicans regarded it as unwise. We had debated that among ourselves. The issue where Kagan and I endorsed Clinton's intervention in Bosnia at the very beginning of December 95, so that's 3 months after the magazine started, we published Charles Krauthammer dissenting from that. But certainly the magazine has moved more, I'd say, in that direction. Charles has moved in that direction certainly since 9/11. I think we lost about a fifth of our original subscribers when they picked up this wonderful conservative magazine, you know, a 10th issue supporting Clinton and criticizing Phil Graham and others for attacking the intervention in the Balkans. But on foreign policy, we ended up articulating what's now called a neoconservative viewpoint on foreign policy. Others had been there first. Kagan had written very important pieces for Norman and Neil and commentary actually before the Standard started, but I think we became a major bearer of that. On governance, I would say we were always, in maybe slightly different ways, but we were always more interested in limited but energetic and successful governance than simply opposing government. David Brooks wrote a very early piece on Rudy Giuliani, I think in early 96, saying this, in fact, is sort of the model for, could be a model for successful conservative governance, and you know what, his policies could actually work. And this was a little bit against not just a kind of libertarian anti-government sentiment, but a little bit against one stream of neoconservatism, actually, which was much more fatalistic about what could be accomplished by public policy. John DiIulio says in his piece in the Symposium that he was wrong. We published his piece early on saying demography is destiny, family breakup is horrible among the underclass, and there's going to be a crime wave over the next 10 years. Because these kids, we have a huge amount of social science data showing that these kids, unfortunately, a high percentage of them are going to not make it in America and become criminals. And policy turned out, to some degree at least, to be able to trump, I think, this is what John says, and I rather agree with him, and I think this was always our instinct, I mean, that policy can trump demography or culture even more than people expect. And thus, we were sort of always been interested in energetic conservative governance as opposed to simply a kind of Tory fatalism on the one hand or a libertarian hostility to government on the other. And on the culture issue, I think Jody has it about right. We were certainly mostly socially conservative on most issues, but how to say, constructively socially conservative, maybe, as opposed to simply lamenting the state of things in today's America. So I think on all those things, we ended up with a neoconservative, and I think if you put those together, that is sort of where neoconservatism, that is a neoconservative sensibility or persuasion, which we more or less embody, though we have dissidents, and we publish things that don't fit, obviously, and we in the Symposium itself, P.J. O'Rourke begins his piece by saying, "What, you know, politics is evil," and he's not giving up at all. His Caldwell says he's discounted his libertarian holdings in his Symposium. That's his big lesson of the last 5 years. His libertarian views were worth less than he thought. But P.J. is hanging tough on his anti-government views, so we have obviously some differences among ourselves. But I would just say on the issue of neoconservatism, we ended up being neoconservative sort of without intending it, which is fine. Anyway, so comments, questions?
Bill, you said you're even square on abortion. I wonder where you and the panel stand on Iraq compared to where you were in the beginning of 2003. Where are you now?
Start with this because I speak as a voice on this panel that does not share the magazine's, the skepticism that the magazine had displayed about either the battle plan for Iraq or the post-war period, which may sound like a peculiar thing to say given the news of this week and the whole question about whether or not we had too few troops or too many troops or whether what has been done incompetently or not incompetently. I believe that what is happening in Iraq, the war for Saddam's overthrow and the subsequent 2 years, is a policy unique in the annals of world history. It is something in some ways that has never been attempted. To describe it as incompetent, as so many people do simply now as a matter of course, is an act of arrogance in itself, because it presumes that one can discern in other policies that could have been taken a course that would have led to a result at this moment that would have been better. That is, it's conceivable that had we brought in 75,000 more troops after the war was over, that the result would have been better. I can also come up with scenarios, since it didn't happen, but I can come up with scenarios in which we would have been having arguments about a month and a half into it about whether or not we were being too heavy-handed, whether the occupation you know, was so we were infantilizing the Iraqis. We weren't allowing them enough control. This argument would have been made by opponents of the war, as opposed to the argument that people started making, which is that, you know, which is that we hadn't done enough to secure public safety and deal with sort of the infrastructure problems there. So my view remains that the effort to take a country living under the yoke of tyranny to liberate it under force of arms, and to find without as some people would say the total destruction of the country, as was the case with Germany and Japan, and to find a way forward is something that, because it has never been attempted before, is too easily criticized for the bad handling, because we'll only know how to do it the second time we do it, if there is a second time. And that, to me, is actually the more modest and less arrogant take on how the Bush administration pursues this, which is to say that, in some sense, they don't really know how to do it, and they don't actually claim to know how to do it. They're trying everything that they know how to try. That would be my line, and you can now hear the skeptics.
I'm not really one of the skeptics. I've agreed with some of the skepticism and not with others expressed by others at this, as John says, heterodox magazine. The truth is, though, it's all been offered under the umbrella of strong support for the war in Iraq, strong support for what's happened on the political side in Iraq, and I think growing optimism, at least that I have, and John, you probably share, over the chances of ultimate success in Iraq. I mean, I think the Constitution will be approved on October 15th. I think that the war, there has been a turn in favor of American troops and Iraqis in defeating the terrorists, certainly minimizing their impact despite the attacks in Baghdad on Tuesday. And I'm increasingly optimistic about Iraq. It was the right thing to do, and we've always thought that, despite some questions about the way it's been carried out.
I think that, and I think it was necessary to do, it was right to do. I think we'll prevail. I'm more skeptical about the execution than John, and I would say if you go back and look at the December 1st, 1997 issue, where we say Saddam must go, and have articles by Wolfowitz and Khalistad, that's one article, and if Peter Rodman, I can't remember, a couple of Kagan and I wrote the editorial, and then an article by Fred Kagan, Bob's brother, who's written for us a lot, saying, be careful, don't try to do it with too few troops. That's always been a strain of argument. There's been a contrary argument among neoconservatives. Richard Perle has made the opposite case, and still would make it today, and he's very convincing at times. I mean, makes the case very strongly. I'm not convinced, but that, you know, the problem was not handing it over more quickly to the Iraqis, and in fact, it was too heavy-handed an occupation. So there's a big debate, obviously, about that, which we will never know since it's a condition contrary to fact. But no, I think in terms of the necessity of the war, the unimaginability of prosecuting the broader war on terror while leaving Saddam in power in Iraq, about the moral justice of the war, and about the, I think that the outcome of the war will be okay. I think we're mostly in agreement on that. The Standard always had some crypto dissidents on Iraq, but they expressed it occasionally, but that was certainly, we were mostly strongly for it and really thought it was necessary. And I would say about this, however difficult things are in Iraq, and they are difficult, on the big predictions about what would happen in the Middle East, I think we are much more vindicated than our critics. What was the core prediction of the Brent Scowcroft School? The Arab street will go nuts. Radicalism, extremism, friendly governments toppled, recruiting for terrorists, and Muslim Brotherhood skyrocketing and all. And it really hasn't happened. I mean, the developments in general in the Middle East are pretty promising. Now, we don't want to be overdo it here, but if any, the Arab street seems to be moving more in a democratic and liberal, I would say, direction. And indeed, even the religious Arab street is at least thinking about questions of separation of mosque and state and how to reconcile religion and democracy, rather than sort of erupting in a spasm of anti-American anger. So I would say that, you know, the terrorist best recruiting decade will remain, still will have been the 90s when we pursued a different policy, and in that respect, the broader Bush policy, as Fred said, I think we strongly support.
One final point.
Had Iraq something to think about politically, again, arguing something that didn't happen, had the Bush administration not gone to war with Iraq in the 2 years after 9/11, or the 3 years after 9/11, the major Democratic foreign policy issue in the Democratic Party would have been Bush's failure to go to war to topple Saddam Hussein, somebody who, you know, the world knows possesses weapons of mass destruction that will threaten American cities. That, if you think about it for 3.5 seconds, what you come up with is a Democratic Party that would have sought and would have been successfully sought to some extent to get to Bush's right on foreign policy. Iraq would have been the issue. Unquestionably, Iraq would have been the issue.
Stanley Renshin, the former head of the PhD program at the City University of New York Graduate School, in his book on George W. Bush, In His Father's Shadow, makes a very strong case that one of the more controversial aspects of Bush himself is that he is willing to be a transformational president. He's done it in the foreign policy arena. He's done it in the domestic arena. Do you feel that that's a good categorization of this particular president and leads to a great deal of misunderstanding about what he is attempting to do?
Let me let Fred answer that and close out with that, since this Fred has just written a book on this topic, which will be out in January, and you should all buy, even though it's not published by HarperCollins. Fred's book will be called, what, The Rebel?
Rebel in Chief.
Right, very good title. I mean, it's funny that the small world category, Stanley Renshin, just yesterday I got in the mail the galleys of Stanley Renshin's next book, which I gave to Phil Terzian, who succeeded Jody as back of the book editor, and suggested we review because it looked quite interesting. So it's funny, just funny that I hadn't thought of that name in a while, and then I got the book yesterday and you mentioned it today. But Fred, talk about Bush.
Well, I have written a whole book about this. It is called Rebel in Chief, and about how Bush became a history-making president, and he has, I don't use the word transformative a lot, but I have read Stanley Renshin's book, actually. It was one of the first books I read when I got a contract with Crown Forum to do this book. Actually, my editor, Jed Donahue, is sitting in the back here somewhere. There he is. And that's what the book about. And Bush, unpredicted by any of us anyway or anybody else, is a president who came in and has stood policies on their head. Look what he's done in the Middle East. Look what he's done. John talked about the Bush doctrine of promoting democracy, aggressively promoting democracy around the world. If Bush ever fully fleshes out his idea of an ownership society, it is something that would replace the liberal impulse and the New Deal and the Great Society and remove power from government and give it to people and so on. He's a very radical president, and nobody expected him to be. Now, Stanley Renshin's book, I would disagree with one thing, though. He thinks that 9/11 utterly changed Bush and turned him into this president. I think there was a lot there to begin with, and while 9/11 certainly energized him a lot, it wasn't the critical event. There was something there before that that I hadn't noticed, and I don't know anybody who did.
But there was something critical there, Fred. Something... I think we forget, just think of this in terms of the history of the magazine, we forget how we were riding wave after wave through through the late 90s, but there was also a sense in some degree that the magazine was floundering around looking for something to say, and that conservatism itself, although it was winning in certain ways, we went from talking about Bosnia to the Clinton impeachment to the election, and we rode those waves, but I remember conversation after conversation with conservatives and with writers at the magazine during that period saying, you know, what's conservatism about? Todd Lindbergh takes over Policy Review and writes in his first editorial for that magazine that conservatism is a finished body of thought and there's nothing left to say. And there was a feeling like that around a great deal. I mean, we ran in the Weekly Standard, in the issue we put out just before 9/11 happened, we had Gilligan's Island on the cover. There was a sense there that we were looking for
piece.
It was a good piece, and yet. It was a very good piece, and yet. And yet, you know, there was a kind of sense that we weren't sure what we were going to do next and how we were going to put it all together. And September 11 did change that.
Now we've it's good to work with you. We conclude with Jody discussing how we were floundering around for most of our... I wouldn't quite use that term, but no, we did have on the newsstand, I mean, not to minimize, not to mix, you know, farce with genuine tragedy, and obviously, but the magazine that we put out September 10th, that arrived in the newsstands Monday, September 10th, had a very interesting piece by Paul Cantor of the University of Virginia on sort of the change in television shows from the 60s and 70s to the 90s and to today.
It was Brooks's review of Cantor's book.
I'm sorry, you're right. It was Brooks's review of Cantor's book, and the cover line, the picture of Gilligan on the cover, and the cover line is Farewell to Greatness. So that shows that, yes, that was, luckily, 9/11 was horrible, but the country turned out to be, and this was something we did discuss a lot in the next few months, was the country turned out to have reserves of strength, really, and I would even say of greatness that perhaps we were all too skeptical about before then. Anyway, thank you very much.